This episode is brought to you in part by Brewers Publications, publisher of Goza, brewing a classic German beer for the modern era by Val Allen. Visit brewerspublications.com to order a copy of Goza or browse their entire collection of beer and brewing titles, more than 50 in all. That's brewerspublications.com. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, March 14th, 2019. That's Pi Day. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Mike Tonsmeyer, the mad fermentationist and co-founder of Sapwood Cellars in Columbia, Maryland, joins us to talk about his new brewery and what it's like to scale up from homebrew batches to commercial brews. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows, our DVDs, our brewer's logbooks, and other Basic Brewing gear, including our tie-dye silicone pint and our brewing rainbow shirt. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram, at Basic Brewing, and find our show page on Facebook. We have a cool Basic Brewing app on iTunes and Amazon.com, and we're found all over the place where fine podcasts are served up. And if you do us the favor of rating us on iTunes and maybe leaving a nice comment, they say that that will help new listeners to find us. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing, and thanks to everybody who's helping out that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter, including this past Monday, I posted for financial supporters an early release of a video and a behind-the-scenes video along with a recipe for the next episode of Basic Brewing Video. In this one, it's my no-chill Brett Golden Ale, where I skipped the chilling process on brewing day thanks to a frozen garden hose. Then, after fermentation, I added Suburban Brett from Imperial Organic Yeast in the bottling bucket. This one is a tasty beer, and I hope it will continue to evolve in flavor over time, sort of like Orval. I will also be checking bottles from time to time to make sure that they're not getting over-carbonated along the way, which is something you got to look out for if you put Brett in the bottling bucket. My wife Susan and I also bottled my Instant Pot Juicy Imperial IPA. I put a picture of that on Instagram. I figure it finished out at around 8% alcohol by volume. It is very juicy in flavor going into the bottle. Very cloudy, which may put some people off. But I say just close your eyes. It finished pretty high at 10.20, but it started out pretty big, so I'm okay with that. I'm right at this point. I'm hoping that the yeast has enough viability to bottle condition the beer. So I can tell already that I would tweak the recipe if I were going to use the Instant Pot again, but it certainly is possible to brew a six-pack of beer in the thing, and I did shoot footage of that for Basic Brewing Video. This is just a side note. Registration for HomebrewCon in Providence, Rhode Island this June is open now. Steve and I have our hotel reservations made. Already getting excited about that. You can find out all the details at homebrewcon.org. Let's take a minute to talk about our sponsor, Tavor. You've heard me talk about them on the show. Tavor is a way to select delicious craft beers that you may not be able to find in your area and have them delivered to you. It's not a beer of the month club where someone else chooses the beer for you. You only pay for the beer you choose over the course of the month. Signing up for Tavor is free. Just create an account at tavor.com. That's T-A-V-O-U-R.com. V as in Victor, T-A-V as in Victor, O-U-R.com, and download their iPhone or Android app, and you receive notifications for two new beers each day that are available for purchase with in-depth tasting notes from Philip at Tavor. And if you're not interested, no worries. Just skip the ones you don't want. However, when you see something that you do want, and you will, don't wait. Just click on it to get it and add it to your crate, and your beer arrives fresh every few weeks, allowing you enough time to fill a box and pay the least shipping. So why don't you check it out? It doesn't cost anything to sign up, and there is no obligation to purchase anything. In fact, if I can ask you a favor, go to tavor.com or download the app, and when you sign up, enter the promo code BASICBREWING, that's all one word, and you'll get $10 off your first shipment of $25 or more. Again, it's free to sign up, and there's no obligation to purchase, so get on there and look around and see what they have. Sign up at Tavor.com, T-A-V as in Victor, O-U-R.com, or with the Tavor app and enter Basic Brewing as the promo code. Nice to have Tavor back this week. I follow them on Instagram all the time, and I get thirsty just looking at looking at what they've got. Let's take a look into the mailbag. Last week, I talked about brewing my two-hearted ale clone and using a conical fermenter with a mason jar screwed into the bottom of it. And I said I didn't like putting an empty jar at the bottom of the vessel and then opening the valve and dumping the tube because it caused air to bubble up from the mason jar up through the fermented wort, and I didn't want to oxidize my beer. Well, Jeremiah from Mansalona, Michigan writes, I had a suggestion for you to consider when dumping the tube from your conical. What about filling the mason jar with CO2 prior to connecting it to the conical? Jeremiah says the thought is since CO2 is heavier than oxygen, it will drive the oxygen out. So when you open the valve, CO2 will bubble through the beer rather than oxygen. He says, disclaimer, I am a new home brewer with only 5 batches under my belt and have never used a conical fermenter. Started listening to your podcast in December of last year and have listened to all the episodes in the archives. Wow. I drive a truck for a living, so I have a lot of time to listen. That is a lot of time. This is episode 643 or something like that. So that's a lot of listening in a very short period of time, Jeremiah. And thanks for sticking with us the whole way. And thanks for the note and continued safe driving and happy brewing. Yeah, I think that's a possible solution to the mason jar issue. If you were to fill the jar with CO2 completely before attaching it, that seems like it would eliminate or at least cut down the risk of oxidation, from bubbling up through the fermenter. Appreciate the note. John from Lakewood, California writes, I brewed a stout 2 weeks ago and soaked an oak spiral in bourbon the same day as brew day, and then today I added it into the secondary, along with 3 ounces more of bullet bourbon. My question is, if it doesn't have a strong enough bourbon flavor, do you think I could dissolve my priming corn sugar with some more bourbon and add it for bottling? I'm thinking it might work, but I don't want to ruin it. It's really tasty stout, and it is about 7.6%. Thanks for the note, John. You could mix the priming sugar with more bourbon and add it into the bottling bucket, but what if you overestimated the amount of bourbon that you needed to add the flavor that you wanted? You might over-bourbon your beer. If it were me, I would add the bourbon to the bottling bucket a little at a time until it tastes just perfect, and then add the priming sugar separately. That's just my 2 cents. It does sound tasty. Do you know what else sounds tasty? An ingredient kit from our friends and sponsors, Desiree and Dave from High Gravity in Tulsa. I got an email from High Gravity this week that says, until March 17th, St. Paddy's Day, you can earn 4 times the brew bucks on High Gravity's homebrew ingredient kits. This is for online orders only. Brew bucks can be applied to future purchases. So check highgravitybrew.com for all the details on that. And while you're there, check out the first kit in High Gravity's classic style series, Dry Stout. It's a sharp, dry beer with lingering coffee and a dark chocolate finish. It's low gravity, low alcohol, light-bodied with a high level of bittering, but it's still easy to drink. Boy, it does sound tasty. And of course, you can explore all of your electric brewing options that take the pain out of propane, from single-vessel systems like mine to 2- and 3-vessel electric systems. 5 gallons to 2 barrels, high-gravity electric systems feature the Warthog controller that makes hitting strike temperatures, maintaining mash temperature, and keeping boils stable. Makes all that easy. Check it all out at highgravitybrew.com and use the code EBC75BB to save $75 off your electric gear purchase. That's at highgravitybrew.com. Desiree says you guys are using that code, so good. Save you some money on your great gear. You know Mike Tonsmeyer? He's a longtime friend and author of the Mad Fermentationist blog, along with the book American Sour Beer. And he's now the co-founder of Sapwood Cellars with Scott Janisch. And, you know, he's gone pro now, learning how to take homebrew-sized recipes and turn them into commercial batches. Mike Tonsmeyer, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
It's always a pleasure, James. I look forward to our annual catch-up and get to talk beer with you.
What have you been up to lately?
Yeah, so after 12 years of brewing at home and using my garage and my basement, I quit my job last summer, last June, and opened a brewery with my friend Scott Janisch, who's also a beer blogger and has a book on IPAs in the works. We had originally hoped to sort of do this as a little side gig, but it's once you start dealing with production schedules and tasting room hours and all that, it would have been impossible for us to hold on to our jobs as Sapwood Cellars got off the ground.
And it's working out for you?
Yeah, so far we're getting our first paychecks in the next week or so. Not too bad considering we opened in September and we've been doing pretty well, but a lot of that money gets sort of shoveled back into ingredients and gadgets and upgrades and all those sorts of things.
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize that when you own a business, sometimes you're the last one that gets paid.
Yeah, no, and it's particularly when you're starting out, a lot of the upgrades, maybe make our lives easier. You know, we can brew more beer. We can, spend less time making a batch, things like that. And that's important when you're starting out and working 70 hours a week.
Mm. Now, what's your focus at Sapwood Cellars? What's your elevator pitch when people ask you?
Sure. I really think that there are enough breweries in the world and Maryland is not nearly as saturated as California or Philadelphia or Portland or New Hampshire, but we have about 100 breweries now, and I just think we're at that stage where not every brewery needs to cater to every single potential consumer. I usually liken it to a restaurant. I'm not generally that excited when I walk into a restaurant and see a 25-page menu that has pizza and sushi and authentic Thai food and real Texas barbecue. You sort of know that none of those things are going to be spectacular because very few restaurants could afford the staff and the equipment and the inventory and all that to do so many things well that, they're probably, reheating something that's frozen or doing sort of a half measure interpretation of something. And so for us, it's really a focus on hoppy beers, IPAs, double IPAs, hoppy pale ales, and then sour beers.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that we'll never do anything else. We did a stout, and we've got another stout fermenting now. But we're just not going to be the sort of brewery that if you want an 8% stout in July, you're not going to be able to get one from us. And that's okay. And there are consumers who we won't cater to, and there's four other breweries in town that people are welcome to go to, not to mention beer bars and beer stores and home brewer. You have other options than us.
A friend of mine posted an article on Facebook the other day, and I think the headline was something like, "Hoppy beers are ruining craft beer for the rest of us." And my response was, well, go get something that's not hoppy. There's plenty of options out there nowadays. I mean, we are lucky to be just, inundated with choice in craft beer nowadays.
But it really is amazing. There's another local brewery that opened up, True Respite, not far from us, and they have a brown ale. And it's funny how infrequently you see an English brown ale, even, just a fresh, good local beer. Where it used to be that, everyone had a brown ale and the IPA or the double IPA was maybe the specialty. And now it's just some of those classic styles that 5, 10, 15 years ago were everywhere are now almost nowhere. And a lot of that is consumer demand. We see it when we put a double IPA on, it evaporates. When we do a pale ale, it might stay on tap for a month, 5 weeks. Our most recent batch of Snip Snap, Citra Galaxy double IPA, kicked in, I think, so what we're open 8 hours a day, Thursday, Friday, And it made it through that plus, I think, 3 hours on that Saturday. So we were open for less than 20 hours, and we went through more than 200 gallons of the beer. And so it's just one of those things that, you know, it's we started out with the idea of maybe doing a double IPA once a month. And now it's just if we have a double IPA on it, it draws people in. People get growler fills. People want to try everything else you have on tap at the moment. Sort of the hazy, juicy New England IPAs, and particularly double IPAs, are really what consumers seem to be demanding, at least where we are.
Yeah, but those are ruining, and it's another thing that's ruining beer nowadays is those hazy beers.
Oh, exactly. I still get people commenting that, you know, I must not be a very good brewer if my beer isn't crystal clear. And it's I'd like to see anyone brew a crystal clear beer with 15% oats and 3 or 4 pounds per barrel of dry hopping and all those sorts of things. You can, but it involves sterile filtration and all sorts of other stuff that's going to maybe not make the best beer.
Do you have any outside clients?
Any outside? We send a little beer out, but at this point, it just doesn't make financial sense for us. If we can sell beer in the tap room for $6 a pint, it just doesn't make sense to try to sell kegs that sort of the going price for kegs is the equivalent of selling maybe $2 pints. And just for us, we look at it more as a marketing tool. So we'll do a little tap takeover, a beer dinner, something like that to get our name out there. But honestly, between Facebook and Instagram and Google Maps and Untappd, there really are a lot of consumers who are looking for beer and are willing to travel for it and willing to find us in a little sort of flex space industrial park and come try our beer. We don't have, you know, great foot traffic or anything like that, but still the tasting room does a brisk business, and we've got food trucks, and it's all worked out pretty well so far.
And your reputation, you're sort of you know, your celebrity in the craft beer world, or at least in the homebrewer world, is got to work to your advantage as well.
Sure, but I'd also say that it seems like very few people who walk in the door here have any idea who we are. I think I look at it sort of like soft power. Being that we had these reputations allowed us to hire a fantastic bar manager who's also a home brewer, but who had 4 or 5 years of experience running a local beer bar and putting their beer program together. And he was willing to come, you know, leave his job, work for us at a startup, you know, for probably not quite as much as he was making before, because he was excited to work in the industry and excited about what we were doing and those sorts of things, that he may not have done that for some random brewery that he, you know, had no context for who they were or where they were coming from. And it's certainly amazingly gratifying to have, you know, every day that I'm hanging around the tap room, one or two people will come up and say, "Hey, I recognize you from the YouTube channel," or, "Hey, I just want to say I just finished your book. It was fantastic. I'm a home brewer. I'm on my way traveling from DC to New York, and I just knew I had to, you know, stop off here and you know, try the beers." But the people who really keep us in business are the people who live right across the road, who are in here 2 or 3 days a week, getting a growler, bringing their friends. You know, that's what you need to sort of sustain a business. As great as it is to have people who travel from wide and far to do a one stop, that's not going to keep the lights on.
Hmm. What's your, do you have any ambitions towards, you know, getting a canning line or a bottling line or anything like that?
Yeah, we're getting a small scale bottling set up just really for the barrel aged sour beers. We're working with another brewery at the moment. We can barely keep up with demand just for draft.
Hmm.
And it just doesn't make sense to do sort of mobile canning is the big option. But that would really be turning beer that is currently draft beer into can sales. And the sort of the price point for cans tends to be lower than draft. And the costs inherent to putting beer into cans are more expensive than putting it into a keg. And so we're hoping that, you know, we can do a little bit of offsite production at a place that, really knows what they're doing, that we can be involved in every step of the process, and that they can the beer on their nice high-end canning line. And then we can have some more to-go sales rather than just relying on growlers that can be finicky to fill and take bartenders' time, and that many people just would rather have cans. I'd certainly rather have cans than a growler, that hopefully better shelf life, better. It's just easier. I'd rather have open one can rather than open a half gallon growler that needs to be consumed relatively quickly.
Sure. It sounds almost like you're outgrowing your current system already.
What we're really outgrowing is we just don't have enough tanks. So we have a 10 barrel system, but then we just have two 10-barrel fermenters and a 20-barrel fermenter for the clean beers, and we have a 15-barrel that's dedicated for the sours. So really our problem at the moment is just being able to turn these beers around, particularly when you're talking about an IPA or double IPA. You're adding on almost a week for double dry hopping and then trying to get those hops out of suspension so you can get a good yield. And pretty much where we transferred our most recent IPA to the Bright tank this morning, and now Scott's in the back cleaning that tank so we can brew a hoppy wheat beer into it tomorrow.
Mm. Now, you've sent some beers here. I've got three beers in front of me.
I did.
And hopefully
they held up well. They were just sort of filled off the taps. I purged them and everything, but best of luck to you.
Disclaimers here right off.
Yeah.
You're just from your history, I don't think we have anything to worry about. As I open this first beer, this cashmere beer, I want you to talk about that beer, and also the main excuse that I used to get a hold of you this time was you posted a video on YouTube talking about brewing the same recipe on a homebrew system. I think it was what was it, a $1,500 homebrew system versus a $150,000 commercial system or something like that.
Exactly. And those numbers were let's say adjusted for the clickbaitiness of it.
And it worked.
Exactly. Good. So essentially it was just my old home brewing setup, a couple of 20 gallon stainless steel pots, propane burners, stainless steel brew bucket from SS Brewtech, a little March pump. It's what I've been brewing on for the last, three or four years at home. And then, comparing that to our big system, although by craft brewing standards it's still relatively small, and I really just wanted to show off not making any adjustments, just brewing the exact same beer with the exact same ingredients. Usually when you're going between those sorts of volumes you have to tweak a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And the video is well produced, and you showed each step with each system, and then talked about the sensory data that you received, at the end of it with your customers. But I wanted to talk to you about, the challenges of scaling up on that scale. I mean, most of us are used to going from like 1 gallon to maybe 5 or 10.
Yeah.
It's exponentially more, I guess, for you. So talk about the process. I mean, can you take a recipe that works on your, say, 10-gallon system and just proportionally scale it up and make it work?
That's certainly sort of the first step, would be doing exactly what you would do to go from 1 gallon to 5 gallons, just scaling up those recipes. And for me, the numbers actually are pretty easy generally, because going from 10 gallons to 10 barrels, a barrel is 31 gallons. And so like 31 is pretty close to 32, which would be like 2 pounds. 16 ounces, 32 ounces. And so the numbers can kind of make sense in that kind of context. And so really it's, the first things you have to worry about are the same things maybe going from your system to a friend's system. Is the efficiency of the mash going to be the same? If you're used to getting 70% home, you might do similar, you might do better, you might do worse, depending on the commercial system. So a lot of that is just knowing your system. And we've gotten pretty good at knowing what our efficiency will be given the original gravity of the beer. So usually our sort of total system efficiency, counting losses to the Whirlpool and losses to all that. You know, the amount we get into the fermenter, we're sort of, you know, actually pretty close to what I was as a home brewer, you know, sort of mid 70s for a, a 5% beer, mid to high 60s for a 7 or 8% beer. Mm. And then down into the low 60s, particularly for like a heavily hopped double IPA where we're, you know, losing a lot of wort and leaving a lot of wort behind in the kettle. And so, yeah, it's just like the percentages all work the same. You know, I don't try to mess around with the ratio of specialty malts to base malts or anything like that. I just try to think of them as the percentage. And if you're getting higher efficiency, you'll be getting both more of the character from the specialty malts and also more of the sugars and the fermentables from the base malt. Really, I think the first place that things get really different is with hops. One of the biggest differences at home, if you add when I started home brewing 12 years ago, the best advice people generally gave was to try to chill the wort as quickly as possible. So you'd add the flame out hops and you'd turn on your immersion chiller and you'd be down below 120 degrees in 5 minutes or 10 minutes or what have you. So those hops that you'd added at flame out spend a very small amount of time above the isomerization temperature, above, I forget what it is, 175 or so, 180, you know, where you get the majority of the bitterness. On a commercial system, the hops sit very close to the boil for, at least in our case, an hour or more. We add the flame out addition. We turn on a pump to whirlpool the beer, so it just sort of pumps it around in a circle. That lasts for about 15 minutes. Then we turn the pump off and we let it settle so all the hops fall down and form a cone at the bottom of the kettle for another 15 minutes or so. And then we slowly draw off the wort and pass it through our heat exchanger to cool it down in line on the way to the fermenter. And by the time the last wort is out of the kettle, it's probably been another half an hour or 45 minutes, depending on the time of the year and how quickly we're running the water and what temperature we're aiming for. So those hops during that whole time have continued to isomerize. We've continued to get extraction from them. And even at home, you know, for the last maybe 2 or 3 years, I was doing a hop stand. I think, I forget if it was Randy Mosher or who it was that sort of coined that term a few years ago. But just the idea of leaving the hops in the hot wort for 15, 20, 60 minutes, what have you, before you start cooling. But even at that scale, even if you just turn the flame off after half an hour or 45 minutes for a 5 or 10 gallon batch, it's already probably have fallen, you know, 30 or 40 degrees. And so, again, you'll probably be below that isomerization temperature. And so there's sort of a bunch of different things, you know, different sort of considerations. On the commercial scale, we almost add no hops prior to the whirlpool for our IPAs and double IPAs. We're adding the equivalent of about 10 ounces of hops for a 10-gallon batch at flame out. So it's a big amount, but I don't think it's a crazy amount as far as IPAs go. But that provides most of the bitterness for our beers. Hmm. We'll add a little tiny bit just at the start of the boil, just to make it helps to prevent a boil over. But otherwise, that's pretty much it. We aren't doing a 15-minute addition or a 5-minute addition, just because the hops spend so long hot. At home, most of my IPAs and double IPAs would get a nice charge at maybe 15 minutes, just to make sure they had enough bitterness. To me, a lot of New England IPAs that have, you know, sort of come out in the last couple years have been getting too sweet for my taste. I like them somewhere between sort of that old West Coast tongue scraper and the juicy, fruity kind of thing. To me, they're still IPAs. They should still have a balancing bitterness. I think it makes them more drinkable. I think it makes them taste more the way I want them to taste.
Yeah, someone brought me a can of and I can't remember what the beer was or where it was, but it was delicious. It was a big juicy. They labeled it as a double IPA, and usually my wife Susan would not like that because she doesn't like that, you know, a double IPA's harsh bitterness. But sure, she really liked that beer, and it's not a beer that I would classify as a double IPA just because it's so juicy. And the bitterness, you know, was not as much, but that, you know, maybe I'm just being a traditionalist. so yeah, it's even double IPAs nowadays are changing, you know, at least the sort of definition of them are changing. So it sounds like there are advantages and disadvantages to both the home brewing setup and the commercial setup. I mean, you know, the like you said, if we in the old days when we were adding hops at flame out and then immediately turning on the chiller, we were cheating ourselves with, you know, hop flavor and aroma and bitterness, you know, and things that we're now learning from commercial brewers and extending those hop stands and extending the hot period past the end of the official boil time.
Yeah, well, I don't know if cheating is the right word. It gets a different sort of extraction. Scott is always doing research in peer-reviewed studies, and some of the studies suggest that a lot of the good compounds in hops get extracted very quickly. And he's pushed us to try to figure out ways to even shorten the time, the period that we're adding the hops, or to maybe mix, you know, some hops, early and then some hops later on. We haven't found a good sort of efficient way to do that. But I think there's something to be said for a home brewer that, you know, you could add a bunch of your hops for the hop stand. And then maybe right as you start your cooling, you could add another little dose of hops and get, you know, sort of some different compounds, you know, the more volatile compounds that might be lost from the long hop stand, and, you know, add them back in with the smaller addition, particularly for, say, a lower alcohol beer where you didn't want a whole bunch of bitterness from the hop stand.
So before we get too far along, talk about this Cashmere Hazion.
Yeah, we're calling it Saison, at least in Maryland, is no longer the hit name it maybe was 5 or 6 years ago. And so we figured to upplay the fact that this was a dry hop Saison, and it's hazy. It had a bunch of spelt malt in it from Weyermann in it. We'd call it a Hazon. And so this is fermented with the Saison house culture I've been maintaining at home for about 4 or 5 years now. It started as a combination of a couple of Saccharomyces strains from the yeast bay, and I added, back when it was Brettois, but it turned out to be Sactois from White Labs, the wild Saccharomyces sort of super fruity strain, and then an isolate from an old Cantillon lambic that a friend of mine pulled out. I sent some off to Bootleg Biology, and they've kept a culture of it, and they do a release every once in a while, but we've just kept my old homebrewing culture going. We grew it up in a small sort of propagation batches. We served it a small, I guess we had some old malt, and we just did a practice batch and saved maybe 60 gallons of wort to grow up that initial culture from 5 gallons to 60. And then we did a full batch on top of it, and we've just kept it going since then. And so this beer was, it's pretty much what I was doing at home. I did a very similar beer last summer with buckwheat flour. It was flour is a little messy to deal with, and so we were interested in doing spelt. It's high in protein. It's doesn't have as distinct a flavor. And we used a big dose of aged Cascade hops at flame out. There's some interesting research, and these weren't aged in the lambic sense. They were stored cold and vacuum packed, so they weren't oxidized. But 2015 Cascades, rather than being, you know, say 7% alpha when they started, would be down to maybe 2%. And so again, we could add a nice big dose, the equivalent of probably 5 ounces in a 10-gallon batch, and they still have a lot of those nice fruity aromatics in them, but without as much bitterness. I think some Saisons are a little underbitter. I think it's a style that does need a little bitter snap to it. Nothing like an IPA, but enough to balance some of the sort of, not that there's a lot of sweetness left in them, but this one finished at almost zero. It was, I think, 1.001.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, it still has a little bit of body thanks to the spelt.
Yeah, it's got substantial, not you know, double chocolate stout mouthfeel, but it's got, you know, substantial mouthfeel to it. But is there any, are there any spices in this beer?
No, it's just that yeast blend. So we did a 10-barrel batch of it, and then we've got this little 3-barrel fermenter that will siphon off some of a beers from our quote-unquote sour tank and then do something fun with them. So in this case, while the rest of the Saison without dry hops went into kegs and we did natural conditioning with sugar, just like you would for bottle conditioning, we just quickly dry hopped about 90 gallons of it with 5 or 6 pounds of cashmere. And I really like cashmere. It's got some of those sort of like a lemongrass and some spicier notes, but along with some sort of more classic citrus.
Yeah, there's a lot of citrus. There's I would swear that there was something like coriander or something in there that, you know, it's probably the yeast playing with the hops and kind of a combination of a lot of flavor characteristics in there. It's delicious. It's very drinkable.
Yeah.
Very nice.
And that's, I mean, I think that's an old Stan Hieronymus line about, you know, Belgians wanting to brew where you can't quite tell whether it's a spice or a hop or a yeast that's kind of in that intermediary place. We did a version of that base beer with black pepper and fresh lemon zest that I really enjoyed.
Mm.
We try to, every week, we try to do some flavored variant on one of our other beers just as an excuse to experiment and sort of, you know, let those funny homebrewing ideas come out. And hey, if we have a hit, then we can always make a bigger batch of it.
Now I'm gonna open the next beer while you talk some more. This is the Cheater Hops 5.
Yeah, so for a long time, Scott and I have had a running joke that there are some hop varieties that are so good it's like cheating. You know, if you can make a great IPA with Galaxy and Citra, really, what's the brewer doing? You know, you're making a beer that tastes like Galaxy and Citra. You know, if you can make a delicious New England IPA only using Chinook and Columbus and Summit, that's the brewer's talent. And so these are sort of our showcase of what we consider to be the best hops. Mosaic, Simcoe, Amarillo, Citra, Nelson. So in this case, we used a ratio of 2-1 Nelson Savin and Citra Cryo hops. And we do sort of, again, that classic New England thing, a bunch of oats and wheat generally. We use an English strain that's related to London 3, the Boddington strain, 1318 London Fog. But ours is from a local yeast lab, RVA, that we really like. It gives it just this very light vanilla hint that I think is a fun counterpoint to the citrusy hops. And that's one of the ones we've been happiest with. So that's the fifth one we've done. We just transferred the sixth today, and we're planning the seventh for a week or two from now.
Boy, that's like a fruit salad. That's it's like a lot of the juicy beers, or you know, some of the ones I've made, especially have kind of a one note, you know, lots of grapefruit kind of a thing.
Yeah.
But this is more of, like I say, kind of a fruit salad where, you know, there is a grapefruit, but then there's like mango, and then there's some stone fruit in there too, maybe some peaches, and you know, there's just a whole bunch of. It's like a church picnic fruit salad kind of a thing that is really complex.
Yeah, and we in addition, so we will dry hop with the fancier, more expensive varieties, and I won't say that we couldn't afford to do Nelson and Citra on the hot side, but in our tests, both at home and here, it doesn't seem like the nicest hops for dry hopping necessarily make the best hops or necessary for the kettle edition. So I'd actually have to look at exactly what we used in the kettle on this, but we use a lot of Columbus, Centennial, Cascade, hops that have a lot of good oils, but maybe don't have that wow signature sort of character. Recently, we've been really impressed by Idaho 7 as a Whirlpool edition. It just adds a really big, wonderful, fruity flavor. We haven't used it extensively for dry hopping yet, but it's sort of raised our hopes for it. And we've done some. They're fermenting now with Azaka and a few others in that kind of mid-tier range. You know, that at the brewery, we pay sort of, you know, $7, $8, $9 for the less expensive hops. So the mid-range is, like, you know, kind of like 10 to 13. And then for like Nelson or Galaxy, it can be all the way up to $30 or $35 a pound. So wow. it gets pretty steep pretty quickly. We're lucky to be able to get those hops and paying on the secondary market when you're selling the beer by the glass it can really help when you're selling an IPA for $6 or $7 a glass rather than selling a keg of it to a bar for a couple hundred dollars. Mm. But you know, that's one of the other big things that you have to worry about as a brewery compared to a home brewer. As a home brewer, we all like to save a little bit of money, but you know, it is a hobby, and you're well within your rights to splurge a little bit or spend a little bit more money than is necessary because it's what you love and you're making a delicious beer, and it's still going to be less expensive than buying a beer. But on a commercial scale, it's not. Making the best beer possible is certainly part of the game, but also making the best beer, spending the least money to make a given quality of beer is important. There's no sense in wasting money if it doesn't make for a better product in the glass.
Now, Steve and I have been doing this hop sampler series where I brew an extract batch of beer, a 1 gallon batch, and I don't boil. I just bring it up to the boil and then I add hops and let it stand for 30 minutes. And then we taste the beers. And, you know, I'm kind of frustrated because I don't have an adequate way to predict bitterness. And I actually sent some beers off in an episode that, as we speak, I'm going to post in a couple of days, but this will be in the past by the time. So I sent beers up to David Curtis up at Bell's, and he actually had them lab tested, some of these beers. And so, you know, using just that 30-minute hop stand, I was able to get, you know, like 45 IBUs, you know, for a certain quantity of hops. And so,
yeah.
You know, it's – you are extracting bitterness in these hop stands. But how do you calculate bitterness? I mean, how – is it just experience that you know if you put this many hops or this much hops at this alpha acid? Or is there a formula that you go to that you can plug in and get adequate – accurate IBU predictions?
Yeah, it's tough. We for the most part don't publicize the number of IBUs for that very reason that we use Beersmith. It now has, I think, Beersmith 3. They added a supposedly better prediction for whirlpool hopping. You can put in a time and a temperature and it'll spit out a number. But the numbers it spits out are very high. Hmm. I think it thinks that the Cheater Hops is 108 IBUs or something like that. and I don't. I mean, it's not. I don't think.
No.
And so the problem is you're stuck with either saying it's 108, which will then people will be confused because it's not that bitterness. Or you just would have to make up a number, but an IBU is like a real testable thing. You know, it's not like saying, how citrusy is it? Oh, I think it's an 8 out of 10 citrusy. It's, you know, an IBU is it would be like guessing at the alcohol percentage or guessing at the final gravity. So we just sort of know based on that formula about what we like in a beer. So that a pale ale might be 60 or 70, an IPA might be 95 or 100, and a double IPA might be a little bit higher than that. But what it actually is something we haven't dug into yet. We're just getting to the point where I think we're going to send a couple of our beers for testing just to get a basis for, you know, what that number is versus what the actual is.
It's kind of like what I've been harping on. You know, I've come up with this idea of the hop stand bittering unit, which doesn't have any basis in measurable IBUs or anything, but it's just a benchmark. You know, with my brewing, with my setup, with my recipes, you know, if I put this formula together and I come up with a number, that's just kind of something for me to look at and say, okay, that's more, if I were to brew this recipe, it would be a little more bitter than this previous recipe that had a lower that number.
Yeah.
So it sounds almost like you're using that calculation as that sort of benchmark within your own system, within your own brewery.
Yeah, it's tricky too. There's also some research that suggests that dry hopping pulls IBUs out of solution. It adds alpha acid, but pulls out isoalpha acid, which is more bitter. And so it really, the IBU is a lot more complex than it seemed when people were just doing, you know, a 60-minute and a 15-minute addition, you know, and then chilling quickly. That's a relatively predictable maneuver when you're dealing with hop stands and dry hopping and all that. It can be the different yeast strains can affect IBUs differently in different grain bills. You know, if you have certain proteins, that can do things. And it's way over my head. And I'm lucky to have Scott, who is willing to read into those things and help me figure out what's going on.
Now we're moving to the third beer, or I am. this one is a Berliner Weiss.
Yeah, so this is one of the only recipes that I sort of brewed several times at home and really didn't tweak. I was so happy with the way it turned out that first batch that I just sort of left it alone. Different Brett strains maybe. This is another good example of lesson learned. Luckily, not by me, but I got an email from a brewery in California that said, "Hey, you know, we use the Berliner Weiss recipe from your book, and we got this horrible DMS problem. It just tastes like cooked corn." And so, of course, as a home brewer, what I was doing was I was bringing it the wort up to a boil, you know, maybe 210, 211, just sub boil. And then flipping on my immersion chiller and cooling it down. And that's not, you know, it's a Pilsner malt-based beer, but, you know, that's not very long, you know, from the time it, you know, crosses sort of, you know, DMS really starts, you know, getting into high production in 170, 180, sort of similar to isomerization. You know, to the boil, it just sort of ramps up. And it really was really only in that temperature range for maybe 10 or 15 minutes at most. Well, big commercial brewery just like us now, they whirlpooled for 15 minutes after getting it to the boil. They settled for 15 minutes. Then they slowly ran through their heat exchanger. So the wort was sitting at 210, 211 for, you know, most of an hour. And so that was a good lesson for us. I applied that, and we didn't take this one over about 175 degrees. So we just went up to 175 to pasteurize, but no boil, and then cooled it down from there. And yeah, it's one of the easiest beers we brew. It just had a couple of pounds of saaz in the mash, just sort of all Pilsner malt and malted wheat. And then the only real letdown for me with this beer was just the total lack of head retention. It got a little bit better over time. I have no idea why. It may have just been, you know, something, but I pulled out all the tricks in the book. I added lactic acid to drop the pH to about 4.4, which is supposed to inhibit lactobacillus from breaking proteins down. We add chit malt, which is an undermodified, it's like carafoam or something like that, but I find it a little bit more effective. All the protein from the wheat. And it's just, we mix ferment with the Omega Lacto blend, the Brevis Implantarum. And at the same time, we pitch USO5, dried American ale yeast, and then this one got the Yeast Bays Melange, which is a blend of a couple of Brett strains and some other lactic acid bacteria that, to me, it's not super funky or super assertive. It's just got kind of a fun lemony, you know, light minerally kind of funk to it.
Yeah, it's crystal clear, which is funny because you didn't boil. So
yeah, and I'll say it also. It wasn't crystal clear from the start. That one was brewed probably back in October, and it has definitely dropped considerably more clear over the months.
Yeah, this is nice. The sourness is bright, without being, you know, enamel dissolving sour or tart.
Yeah, the pH got down to about 3.2, so it got pretty sour. But yeah, it's been interesting. There aren't that many sort of traditional sour beers brewed in Maryland. We have a lot of kettle sours, and I've got nothing against kettle sours, but when we said we were doing sours, I think a lot of people expected heavy fruit, vanilla, lactose, you know, more of a sweet and sour kind of balance. And we've been doing more sour and dry. So it's been interesting, but people, you know, we've had a number of people come in that's their favorite beer. So doing something right.
Yeah, it's extremely drinkable, but it's balanced. It's tart, but again, it's balanced with, and I don't know what it finished at, but it has a perception of having body. And there's a lot of fruitiness, but there's a teeny bit of funk in there. You know, there's a teeny bit of dark, you know, dark funk in there that helps balance that brightness out. You know, it's not a single note, you know, sour beer, which, you know, truth be told is what a lot of my, you know, sours tend to be. It's just, you know, because I am a kettle sour guy.
But I've got nothing against kettle sours, and particularly I think they're terrific if you're adding other big flavors. If you're dry hopping or adding fruit, it seems like a waste to go through a whole lot of time and effort making this delicate, nuanced thing only to launch an armada of cherries and citra at it.
or to do a hop stand with a bunch of fruity hops or something like that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I think one of the things that helps the body on a lot of our drier beers is that we go for higher chloride. Chloride is sort of classic for New England IPAs now and malty beers, but in sours, getting 100 or 150 parts of chloride really helps to lend a little of that roundness, that impression of body that a softer water might not.
Now, what about yeast? I mean, when you're scaling up from, you know, a homebrew setup where you can make a, you know, 1 or 2 liter starter and be good, how much of a challenge is it to scale up to, especially when you're using, you know, sort of, yeasts that may not be readily available quickly, you know, from a manufacturer in a short order of time?
Sure. It's planning is certainly something that we have slowly gotten better at. As a home brewer, you know, I did a combination of ordering online and going to the local homebrew store, but you sort of, you know, you need to think about, it's Monday, I'd better figure out, you know, what I need for this weekend. For us, we try to do sort of one grain order a month from Brewer Supply Group. And so we have to sort of figure out exactly what the malt bills for the 6 or 7 batches this month will be. We start looking at our spot hop suppliers, around the same time, try to order all the hops, and then schedule out the month. And so we know, hey, we're getting a fresh pitch of this yeast, and we need to put that into a relatively low alcohol beer that isn't going to have a lot of dry hops in it before we harvest the yeast. And then, okay, so maybe a week after that or 8 days after that, we can brew the IPA with that same yeast. And then later that week, we'll try to do the double IPA. We've been relatively conservative in how often we reuse yeast. Generally, we'll get 3, 4, 5, 6 batches out of a given yeast and then start over. Just for us, it isn't worth the added risk to try to keep reusing it and keep harvesting it and repitching it and harvesting again, because it's at our price point where we're selling out of the tap room. One dumped batch because the yeast had a problem would wipe out, you know, a year or 2 years worth of savings from reusing the yeast more times.
Yeah.
And then we're also just okay just ordering a pitch, and sometimes it's just for one beer, and that's okay. For a lot of the bacteria and the bread, I'm a little bit more comfortable propping it up myself because we're already adding, you know, lactobacillus and Brettanomyces and PDO. If my sanitation isn't hospital yeast lab sterile, it's a lot less of a risk than if that something like that got into a pale ale or something like that. We've got the added advantage too that very few of our beers leave the tasting room, so that if there were something to go wrong, I mean, the beer is being stored cold. We're tasting it on a regular basis, and we know that you know, we can always take it off if there's something wrong, or if, you know, we'd notice if carbonation was building up. And honestly, harvesting yeast on a commercial scale with cylindro conical tanks is a lot easier than it is for a home brewer, unless you have a conical too. We can, you know, we usually partially cool down to about 56 to 58 degrees, and then we'll, you know, run out the whatever yeast doesn't look good. And then once it starts looking good, we'll divert it right into a modified keg that we can store the yeast in, a brink, and leave it there until we need it. And then we can hook up CO2 and put it on a scale and push in 25 or 30 pounds, whatever we need for the next batch. And we're just now starting to get to that point where we're looking at microscopes and going to start doing, you know, more cell counting. At this point, we've sort of just been doing that, the homebrew thing of estimating the density of the slurry and, you know, pitching approximately how much we need. And it's probably not the most accurate way. I'm sure plenty of your homebrew listeners do a better job than we do with that kind of thing. But yeah, there's only so much you can bite off at first, and that seemed like something we could get away with until we had time to really clamp it down and focus on it.
Well, I guess the proof of the brewing is in the tasting, right?
Exactly, and that's the important thing too, is making sure you drink the beer regularly. It's actually been one of the big changes in my life, is I just don't have time to drink anymore like I used to. I used to get home from my desk job at 5 o'clock and you know, try something off of the kegerator and make some dinner and, you know, maybe have another beer with dinner. And now it's, you know, when you're brewing, and honestly, the biggest change for us has just been the cleaning, and dealing with caustic and acids and harsh sanitizers. Once your brew day is done, really the most dangerous time starts. And you're dealing with pressures and you're dealing with gas. For us, it's not worth having any alcohol when we're going to be doing those sorts of things.
Yeah.
By the time you're done at, you know, 30 or something like that, you know, it's almost time to, you know, get in the car and go home and make some dinner and, do it all again the next day. And so that's, you know, it's almost have to force myself to make sure I don't even make it to, try all the beers we have on tap at least once a week, have a couple ounces just to make sure it's tasting right and get a sense of, how long these beers are holding up well for future reference. But yeah, it's a lot of time spent dealing with beer and not necessarily the most fun parts of it. You know, at home, you know, you sort of finish up a batch and throw a OxyClean Free or PBW in there and you're done. And I'm honestly, I get the better end of the deal. I come in early on brew days. I start things off. I mash in. And Scott then sort of to pay me back for me showing up 3 hours early, he'll stay 3 hours late to run the cleaning cycle on the heat exchanger or get in the kettle and scrub it or wow, whatever it is.
You got the better end of the deal, I think.
I think so. I don't tell him that.
Hopefully exactly. Well, Mike, these beers are delicious, and I'm very excited to have had them.
Yeah, and please, next time you find yourself up in Maryland in Columbia, please let me know, and we'll have you over for a brew day or something.
Awesome. That would be a dream, and I'd even get there early with you.
Please do, 8 a.m.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for having me, as always, James.
Thanks again to Mike. Those beers were delicious. And he also sent along a homebrew, a Berliner Weiss brewed with staghorn sumac that Mike foraged from alongside the road. That beer was amazing as well. And I got to share it with Steve after we shot the latest couple of videos. And it's a good thing, too, because I would have felt very guilty keeping it to myself. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form at basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check all that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. You can get a free Basic Brewing bottle opener with any DVD combo. You can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store, too. You can find our logbooks, or you can track and log up to 50 batches of beer. Check all those out at basicbrewingshop.com. Also, take a look at our silicone pints while you're there. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer, production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website. is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.